Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know the theory that everybody just goes on vacation in late August and there is nothing going on? Looks like somebody forgot to tell the mergers and acquisitions folks. Numbers out today show companies are buying and selling each other like it's 1999. Seriously, it's an 11-year high. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Happy Friday, everybody. It is the 20th of August today. Good to have you with us. You know, I saw a tweet from our Friday regular Heidi Moore this morning that caught my eye. She was talking about a Thomson Reuters study she'd seen. It showed that there's been $200 billion worth of corporate deal-making done this month. $200 billion in mergers and acquisitions. And it's August, as in the month when the whole world is basically on vacation. In fact, this is the busiest August we have had in 11 years. Yesterday, as we told you, Intel said it was buying McAfee, the computer security company. This one doesn't really count since it's not a done deal. But Tuesday, BHP Billiton tried to take over a huge Canadian fertilizer company to the tune of $40 billion. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out why these companies are so darned hungry.
One reason companies want to do deals is interest rates are so low, financing them is cheap. But a lot of companies have saved so much money they can pay cash, and it's cash they don't necessarily know what else to do with. James Brock is a professor at Miami University in Ohio. He says buying other companies is an easy option.
You know what I think it offers? I think it offers this kind of romantic illusion of fast growth.
Emphasis on illusion. He says historically, most of these partnerships don't last. Think Daimler and Chrysler or AOL and Time Warner. One question is why companies don't invest their savings in themselves, hire more workers, or build new plants. Brad Hintz is an equity analyst at Sanford Bernstein. He says an acquisition, if it's at the right price, can be the better bargain.
When the stock market's valuations are low, it's actually cheaper to go out and buy whole companies and get their workers that way than it is to go out and hire workers and invest in new plant and equipment.
Maybe. But James Brock says there's also the potential for companies to get carried away.
They get all hot and excited and they got lots of money. And so they sort of step up to the bar and unload their wallet. And then the next morning is sort of regret.
And the more deals there are, the more potential there is for overpaying, since companies worry about losing a deal to the competition. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
My apologies in advance if this next story makes you squirm a little bit, but bed bugs are back, and they're back in a very big way. And they have moved well beyond just beds. They've been spotted in movie theaters and stores, and even, we hear, at the offices of the fashion magazine Elle. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports.
Bed bugs creep out in the dark, find you sleeping soundly in your bed, and suck your blood. Ken Haynes is a professor of entomology at the University of Kentucky. He says the bed bug population has exploded in the last 10 years.
Probably the main factors that are leading to that increase has been resistance to the insecticides that we have available for controlling them.
People used to kill off bedbugs with DDT and other homier remedies that were also bad ideas, like pouring kerosene around the bed. This week, Ohio asked the EPA to reconsider a rule against using a commercial-grade insecticide. The EPA says it could cause nervous system problems for kids. Missy Henriksen is with the National Pest Management Association.
Bedbugs have been identified as the most difficult pest to treat, more so than roaches, more so than termites, more so than ants.
She says 95% of exterminators report treating bedbug infestations this year. In 2000, only about a quarter of them did. Sounds like good news for the industry, especially as termites are becoming less of a problem. But it's not easy work for the exterminator. Jeff Eisenberg owns Pestaway Exterminating in New York City. He says most exterminations require multiple treatments.
It's overwhelming.
The process is also expensive. Exterminating a one-bedroom apartment can cost more than $1,000. And there's a psychological toll on clients.
They're constantly looking for them all night long. They wake themselves up every 25 minutes trying to find them, and they never do. Meanwhile, they keep getting the bites.
Sleep tight. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
A quick correction from Wednesday's broadcast before we move on. We told you how colonoscopies have become the new and more expensive standard that is used to screen for colorectal cancer. We overstated the American Cancer Society's position on that test. 2 years ago, the Society's screening guidelines made colonoscopies a preferred test. On Wall Street today, not as bad as it could have been. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We call our Friday segment the weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Today, we're going to concentrate on the beyond part. Here to do that with us is Michael Mandel from Visible Economy, also Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Lee, Mike, good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Great to be here, Kai.
All right, so I'm going to cheat, and I can do that because it's Friday in late August, and really the financial news is somewhat thin. So here's what we're going to do, Mike. You ready?
Ready.
We are going to pretend it's not this week, it's not next week, it's September. Everybody's back at work. Politics is heating up. Wall Street's back from Montauk, wherever they go. What's the economic conversation going to be this fall?
The economic conversation is going to be how to get to after the election. You know, the things that are on the table right now is what to do about the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, what to do about stimulus, what to do about Fannie and Freddie, and nothing can get done before the election. So I think we're going to see a month before Congress leaves of basically nothing getting done.
Lee, what do you think? Nothing, nothing?
I would agree with that. I mean, I think when we get back, everything is going to be focused on getting through the election. And I would add to that, you know, jobs, I think, are going to be a huge conversation and what to do about them and what not to do about them and what we can and can't do about them. So I think there's going to be a lot of discussion. Not much is likely to get done.
All right. Well, let me ask you this then. Why is it that the president is talking about this new jobs bill that he wants to get in front of Congress as soon as he gets back? Secretary Geithner spent most of this past week talking about Fannie and Freddie and how to fix them. Are we just going through the motions and we're basically going to wait until the second week in November before we really do anything, Lee?
You know, look, something needs to be done about Fannie and Freddie, and nobody really wants to face just how to do it because it's such a politicized issue and it's such a huge issue. And, you know, don't forget, it kind of got swept under the rug even when it happened. I mean, I don't want to overstate things, but it was so quickly overshadowed by what happened at Lehman and then Bank of America that this is the first time we're really focusing on it. So I'm not surprised that Geithner is trying to address it.
Actually, this is a very important period because what's happening is that everybody's laying the groundwork for what happens after the election. You can either have the Democrats continue to move forward and push ahead on their agenda, or you could have the Republicans striking back, and people are getting ready now.
Oh, good. We're getting ready to get ready? Is that where we are, Mike?
We just had this year where, I mean, the top thing is the health care reform, mm-hmm. which had been on the table forever. So you can view this last year as perhaps one of the most, well, depending on who you are, it's either productive or destructive years that we've had for a long time.
Lee, am I wrong to be frustrated then?
You're not wrong, but I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that we're in a bit of a soup right now. I mean, the first quarter of this year looked really, really good, and then everything kind of fell apart. And so the president's talking about the jobs bill because we really, really need a jobs bill. And we're talking about Freddie and Fannie because we do need to address that. But the momentum that we thought we had is kind of gone. And so I think everyone is scrambling a little bit, and that's adding the uncertainty of the election to it. That would have happened anyway, but everything is much less certain than it was even 3 months ago.
Okay, so here's where go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say that I actually kind of disagree with that a little bit. I actually think that things have been uncertain all the way along. People finally have a moment to take a breath and start thinking about the long-term problems.
All right, well, let me ask you this then, Mike, and here's where you earn your paychecks. Let's fast forward even farther, not to September, but to that mid-November week that I was talking about. What is going to get done? What are the questions going to be? What are the issues are going to be that are going to be resolved?
The first one is what to do about the tax cuts and which part of it.
Yeah, these are the Bush tax cuts set to expire.
The Bush tax cuts that are expire. You don't know what's going to happen until you see the election. On a deeper level, when you think about the jobs situation, people are going to understand that you can't simply create jobs with government spending. You have to think about things like trade, because you look underneath the data and what you see is that there is no real recovery in manufacturing. There's just a lot of imports coming in that's distorting the data.
Mike Mandel, the editor-in-chief of Visible Economy, Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you very much.
A new visitor center opens in Yellowstone National Park next week, and it's a good thing, too, because the world's first national park set a record for visitors last month. Summertime, obviously, is the high season for most parks. But at Yellowstone in particular, a day in the wilderness is starting to look a whole lot like rush hour in Midtown. Jackie Yamanaka of Yellowstone Public Radio in northern Wyoming has the story.
There are five different entrances into Yellowstone, but visitors all want to go to one place, Old Faithful. Richard and Debbie Leonard drove their minivan from Ocala, Florida, to see the geyser.
Oh, yeah, it was the first stop.
That was our first stop.
It was amazing. You know, I told my wife I had trouble keeping it together for a while.
The beauty, just very raw emotion.
At the height of the summer season, about 4,000 people watch each time Old Faithful erupts.
So when is Old Faithful supposed to go next?
The geyser shoots water into the air about every 90 minutes. Once a show is over, most people head for their cars. Yellowstone planner Eleanor Clark calls it the Yellowstone flush.
The exiting traffic is very urban-like. The volumes are just immense to have that many people exiting all at once.
Tourists hop back onto the narrow single-lane roads. This can cause traffic delays, especially when wildlife, like this herd of elk, graze along the road.
And now we have somebody who's decided to turn, so this will take quite a while. On the other hand, it's a great opportunity. Look at these little babies. They still have their spots. They're darling.
Tourists think nothing of stopping in the middle of the road to take pictures. Lee Whittlesey is Yellowstone's historian.
What a lot of visitors see when they come here is what seems to them to be packed roadsides, cars lined up often from a bison jam, you know, or an elk jam or a bear jam, where people stack up to look at animals.
When you finally do arrive at your next destination, you might not find a parking spot. The last major parking update came in the 1960s when there were no large RVs. It creates a problem for folks like Mike Barrow from Squim, Washington.
Is this your vehicle here? Why don't you describe it?
Well, it's a Dodge Ram quad cab 4x4 dually with 11.5-foot Arctic Fox camper and with three pygmy kayaks on top.
Andy's towing a small SUV behind all of that. Barrow is traveling with Steve Singhose. Singhose wishes the park had a shuttle service.
We would be on that, especially if they had a bike rack. We saw they had bike trails there on the Old Faithful grounds. If we could have taken our bikes there, we could have enjoyed the Old Faithful experience.
Yellowstone officials are considering this idea and ways to make bicycling safer. Park planner Eleanor Clark says some roads are too narrow for both cars and bikes.
Winnebago mirrors stick out far enough that they can actually hit bikers.
One way to deal with this is to widen the roads. Of course, that construction would cause additional delays. Yellowstone's historian Lee Whittlesey says the frequent traffic backups lead to long travel times. But it also leads to the longest average visitor stay of any of the national parks. He says at other national parks, the average tourist is there for only half a day.
You go to Mount Rushmore, you see the big heads, you get your ice cream cone and your curios, and you're out of there.
It's different in Yellowstone, where a typical visitor stays almost 2 days, meaning more business in the park and for the small communities just outside its gates. In Yellowstone National Park, I'm Jackie Yamanaka for Marketplace.
Coming up, more evidence that company culture is everything.
This is our nap room. It's been proven the 20-minute nap makes people more effective during the day.
A conversation from the corner office with the CEO of Zappos. No naps involved, though. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slipped 0.5% today, 57 points, closed to 10,213. The NASDAQ ticked up less than a point, 21.79 at the bell. The S&P 500 fell 0.33%, 4 points, finished at 1,071. For the week on by, the Dow off 0.9%, the NASDAQ off 0.33%, the S&P 500 fell 0.7%. Hewlett-Packard reported good profits, but not good enough to offset the damage done by the recent departure of its CEO. HP shares fell more than 2% today. Security device maker ScanSource locked in a 4.8% gain after it released some strong fourth quarter profits. Companies that do business in Europe were hit as the euro lurched lower today. Caterpillar slid 0.2%, 3M and General Electric both fizzled about a 1.4% or so. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.6%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at vanguard.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, it's oh so quiet. The Obama family is on vacation. Congress is on break. UNESCO marks International Day for the remembrance of the slave trade and its abolition. And he conveyed a lot without words. Film star Rudolph Valentino died on August 23, 1926 in New York. He was 31. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The bargain-oriented among you have probably heard of the online coupon site Groupon, right? It normally offers discounts at small local businesses tailored to users in their particular city. Yesterday, though, the deal was a $50 coupon at the Gap for $25. That is 50% off. Demand was so high, we are talking $11 million in coupon sales high, that Groupon servers had a temporary meltdown. It's hard to argue with that kind of success, but a mass market move like that isn't without its risks, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Every day, Groupon members get a coupon in their email. The offers are usually local, from a nearby pub or Pilates studio. Yesterday's Gap coupon went national. Groupon spokesperson Julie Mosler.
The deal with the Gap was the largest scale deal we've ever done.
Groupon isn't even 2 years old, but it has 13 million members and it's valued at more than $1 billion. So offering coupons from big name retailers like the Gap might seem like a logical next step. But Matt Britton, CEO of social marketing firm Mr. Youth, says Groupon should remember it got big by staying small.
Groupon really took off by targeting small businesses, which propel consumers to tell stories. Oh my God, I got this great offer on Groupon. They found this really crazy massage therapist. If it's an offer from the Gap, all of a sudden, it can really lose its edge.
Discovering local businesses is why Los Angeles member Elizabeth Tarian likes Groupon.
I hadn't considered going to the Wax Museum. I hadn't considered going whale watching.
Tarian wasn't a fan of the Gap coupon.
I opened the offer for the explicit purpose of finding something new. To provide me with something from Gap, I can get that a million other places, and it's just now become another piece of spam.
Marketing expert Britton says Groupon is probably under pressure from investors to do larger scale deals. They bring in more money and don't require the legwork and vetting hyper-local offers do.
It'll be interesting to see how they balance being edgy while really capturing the larger revenues from larger companies.
Groupon's Julie Mosler says Groupon will still focus on local businesses, but may start peppering in more national offers. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, a trip to see Tony Hsieh, the CEO of Zappos, the online shoe retailer.
All right, Monica, I'm looking at your order for a pair of Donald J. Pliner Seamas. Is that right?
The main Zappos offices, mostly its customer call center really, are in a generic office park just outside Las Vegas. Dozens of employees sit in cubicles fielding calls about styles and sizes, purchases and returns, all that stuff. In a way, it's probably like most every other call center. Except here, each pod of cubes is wildly decorated, each with a different theme. There's a space alien motif over there, an homage to surfing over here. The 1950s live on down the way. You turn the corner, and between rows of desks and telephones, there's a group of people in party hats cheering on a coworker playing what looks a whole lot like ring toss.
Ingrid! Ingrid! Ingrid!
And that is just the way CEO Tony Hsieh wants it.
For us, our number one priority as a company is company culture, and our whole belief is that if we get the culture right, then most of the other stuff like delivering great customer service or building a long-term enduring brand will just happen naturally on its own.
To see that culture firsthand, we went out to Vegas and went along on one of the 16 tours that Zappos gives of its offices every week.
This is our nap room. It's been proven the 20-minute nap makes people more effective during the day.
As we make our way through the maze of cubicles and conference rooms, different departments introduce themselves with different noisemakers. Western Wear rang some cowbells for us. Dinner bells announced the clothing team. And the travel team, for some reason, happily squeezed rubber ducks. Down the hall in the lunchroom, a woman was singing karaoke pretty well, too, actually. At some point, you figure they are getting work done, but one thing you won't find is an office with Tony Hsieh's name on it. He works at a regular desk in a cluster of cubicles decked out in dark plastic jungle vines. It's known as Monkey Row. I have to ask you the productivity question, because we are here surrounded by people who are, many of whom are working, but there's another sizable group that's standing around chit-chatting. There's a party down the hallway that's been going on for an hour. How does all this affect actually day in and day out selling shoes?
Probably the easiest example to give is when we do new manager orientations, we encourage new managers to spend 10 to 20% of their time outside the office. And so what you're seeing now, you know, consider that maybe away from their desk might be a better term. But a lot of it is actually outside the office, whether it's going bowling with your team or a happy hour with the people you work with and so on. And the initial reaction we get from new managers is, okay, that's great, sounds like fun, but there's a lot of work to do. What about productivity? And then we ask the managers that have done it, how much more productive and efficient is your team because there's higher levels of trust, communication is better, people are willing to do favors for each other because they're doing favors for friends, not just coworkers. And the answers we get back range anywhere from 20% to 100% more productive. So kind of worst case scenario, you break even and you're having more fun doing it.
They're definitely having fun. Zappos has been ranked among the best places in the country to work. All the hijinks don't seem to be hurting the bottom line either. Zappos took in more than $1 billion in sales last year. It's actually been growing at a time when a lot of other shoe retailers are struggling. Maybe because of that, Tony Hsieh has become something of an accidental management guru. People and companies pay thousands of dollars to come and learn the ways of Zappos corporate culture. Hsieh's even written a book about it, a New York Times bestseller, in fact, called Delivering Happiness. It does seem, though, that what is being created here by virtue of your role in this company and your public profile is sort of a two-headed operation. You have this website that sells shoes and now clothing and cosmetics and all kinds of other things, and you have you.
Well, we actually have a separate entity called Zappos Insights, and we help other companies figure out their own values and develop their own strong cultures. Because one of the reactions we get sometimes is, okay, glad you have this strong culture, Zappos happy for you, but this would never work in another industry, in a non-internet company, and so on. But companies from all over the country or world even fly in and
For example, the Atlanta Refrigeration Company does refrigeration repairs out in the field. So in some ways, you can't think of a more opposite company.
They came here? The Atlanta Refrigeration Company?
Yep, they came here. And all right. They went back and really focused on building strong company culture, focused on delivering better customer service. And now they're reporting back that customers are happier, employees are happier, revenues are up, profits are up. And it's just really neat seeing that this type of philosophy of using essentially happiness as a business model working in other companies and other industries.
The first decade it was around, Zappos was an independent company. Last year, though, Shea and the Zappos board sold out to Amazon for more than $1 billion.
There was much consternation in the press, and I imagine in the company, about how that would change your culture. I would say that culture is probably intact, so let me ask you the counterintuitive question. Have you guys changed Amazon's culture at all?
Well, I'll preface it with saying that Amazon is not trying to change our culture, and we're not trying to change Amazon's culture. But at the same time, both of us have a lot to learn from each other. And so the way we've structured it is we think of Amazon as this giant consulting company that has a lot of resources that we have access to, but it's up to us to tap into it as little or as much as we want to. And we actually leave it up to each individual department or sub-department. Some departments, they will have maybe a half-hour phone call once a quarter to check in, and others, like, for example, our warehouse operations, there's a lot to learn from each other because we approached our warehouse operations pretty differently in a lot of cases. And so some of that of what we do has rubbed off onto Amazon and vice versa.
Without looking, can you tell me what kind of shoes you're wearing right now?
Well, yes, because I only have one pair of dress shoes, so they're Donald Pliner.
Oh, man. Tony Shea, CEO of Zappos. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
The whole conversation I had with Tony Shea is, of course, on our website. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, try out our new Zappos-inspired game, Match the Shoes to the Executive. It's harder than you think, actually.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an update about the TARP, the bank bailout from the fall of 08 that you probably remember. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, now says it's not going to cost us anywhere near what we all thought it was going to cost a couple of years ago. The CBO's best guess at the tab, when all is said and done, has gone from the original $700 billion to a relatively paltry $66 billion. CBO Director Doug Elmendorf says on his blog, and yes, that's what you have to read when you host this program, Elmendorf says, but that's because banks are paying it back, the money. They're bailing out Detroit was cheaper than we thought. And, oh, yeah, Congress said the Treasury Department can't spend any more of the money, even if it wants to. So there. And on that note, that is Marketplace on a Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow slipped a half of 1%. That is 57 points. The NASDAQ off less than a point. The S&P 500 fell a third of 1%, 3 points. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson, the executive producer of the program. Is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. So you say you want to teach your kids how to be more savvy with money. What about training them as landlords?
We want somebody who's friendly and person that pays their rent on time.
And no loud parties either. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll be back here on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.